Breaking news, and this one is almost unbelievable.
Yeah, it's all about new customers at Bet365, because they get $150 in bonus bets when they bet $5, win or lose. And even better, bonus bets can be used on the spread, totals, and player props.
There you have it. Bet $5 to get $150 in bonus bets, win or lose. And see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. T&Cs apply. Available in app only.
Welcome to an emergency Edge of Sports podcast. I'm Dave Zirin. The emergency is that you are waiting to hear from me and basketball savant Arya Shirazi about the most gobsmacking NBA title run, and then really the most shocking and distressing NBA Finals game I've ever seen. I mean, the emotions, I mean, crazy. Of course, you know what I'm talking about. Tyrese Halliburton. I mean, to see him 9 minutes into Game 7 on the biggest stage of his life after an improbable, impossible playoff run fueled by his clutch shooting. I mean, of the games he won at the end, an unbelievable postseason. The player voted most overrated by his peers. And here he is in the final game, 7 minutes in. He's got 9 points on three monster threes, and it's all working out. And you think we're going to get this epic game seven down to the wire, and then Tyrese goes down, and they were game for a while, and it fell apart. I hated it. I hated it so much. I just kept thinking it would be like if you watch Goodfellas, and the last scene was Leota hitting the wall, just saying, he would have never found it! And then that's how Goodfellas ends. The end. Very similar. And, you know what? I want to talk about the idea of these Achilles injuries and what we can do about it, because just a quick stat, and then I really do want to throw it to Ari. Just a quick stat. In 2014, there were 5 Achilles tears in the NBA that year, all involving players in deep into their 30s. In 2024-25, there were 8, and mostly in their mid-20s. I mean, you can't just say that's just happenstance. There's something we got to talk about. But I don't want to get to that first. Shiraz, game reaction. It ruined the finals game for me. It ruined a game 7, the two best words in sports. I found the whole thing to be distasteful, quite frankly. Now, if the Pacers had pulled it out, then it would have been utterly incredible. But a double-digit victory by OKC, the Pacers' beautiful offense, completely just, you know, McConnell going one-on-one, Pascal Siakam disappearing. Much to think about, but what did you think of this game 7, and is it like anything you've seen?
Well, it's funny because I was thinking, I was kind of on the way back from the supermarket, a couple of blocks from my house, taking groceries home, when I realized, oh, game 7, it's probably the middle of the first quarter. And that was notable to me because game 7 of the finals, and I hope this doesn't diminish my credentials on this forum even further, despite my abysmal, in addition to my abysmal predictions as of late. But yeah, I mean, what considering it was game 7 of the NBA Finals, as you had just said, like best words in sports, whatever the cliches are, they're true. Game 7s and game 7 in the NBA Finals, I mean, you don't know when you're going to see that again. So it's very special and it's kind of sacred. And I just did not feel that way because I did not feel special about anything involving this series. And I will try to keep my remarks here professional, more on the level as like someone who knows a little something about the game. But my emotional engagement, which is what makes so much of involvement with sports, just was not there, actually. And we can get into kind of that, you know, that's been like a 2-year build. So we can possibly get into that if the conversation goes in that direction. But so I say that also to say that I came home and turned on the game, I think 30 seconds after Halliburton went down. That's what was happening when I turned it on. And I was like, oh, nice. It's only a 1-point game, but everybody's got long faces. So that's what was happening. And, and so good, the game wasn't quite the Goodfellas ending. It was Leota carrying on and then the movie going on for another 15 minutes and then abruptly ending, because Halliburton, the game did not end with Halliburton pounding the floor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you mentioned TJ McConnell kind of, you know, in a not in a positive light. TJ McConnell was the best player in that game for a quarter and a half.
Actually. Yeah, no, I wasn't the denigrating.
The response to Halliburton going down was Indiana playing great until they didn't. And when you don't, Oklahoma is the team that will capitalize and does the best job of not letting you get that close again. So that's what happened, but it didn't. I mean, they did not immediately react in a deflating manner. They played very well. They continued to control the tempo of that game for the entire first half. As you said, with Siakam, and even with a healthy Halliburton, I think Siakam, I felt, was the best player on that team in the postseason through their four rounds. With him having a very subpar game, when they needed him to have an above par game the most. But so it didn't just like they looked like they were going to make it their version of a fairy tale ending. And then they didn't, and the ending sucked.
It was just unbelievable. The loss, my general read on it is, after Halliburton went down, OKC was, and the crowd was more shocked. Yeah, if you'd seen it leading up to it, the crowd was like nothing I'd ever heard. Like, it was even a difficulty hearing the meanderings of Richard Jefferson and Doris Burke and Mike Breen trying desperately to hold on to life. The OKC was not only more deflated, it was like they were confused because they'd worked so hard to think about Halliburton. Everything was geared around Halliburton. And then they get it right after halftime. They adjust. Third quarter, it's 34-20. The thing about McConnell, the fourth is a whole other story. But the thing about McConnell, I mean, he was freaking brilliant putting the ball in the hoop. He also had 5 turnovers in that quarter. Yeah. I mean, and that's the thing. And not only him at all, a couple of people had terrible. I mean, they had like 18. They had a sick number of turnovers in the third quarter. I can't remember the number. I think it was 8. And that's insane. And they were all steals. I mean, think about that. 8 steals in a quarter. It's just it caught up like that. I mean, it made me appreciate Halliburton. Like, this guy can dribble and direct pace in a way that allows for an interesting offense that can possibly win a championship. And it's just these OKC guys, they're like, you know, those fish that eat you up by your knees and ankles. They're just like all over you. So that's my general read on the contours of it. I want to get to the Achilles issue in a big way, but I didn't know if there was anything else you wanted to say about the game.
No, I mean, just, you know, obviously Halliburton and his injury and now his status, you know, for the next season and the future is obviously kind of at the forefront of the discussion. But a fascinating player right now. And you know, this is kind of, you know, overused, or maybe it got so overused that it's not used anymore. I'm not really sure. But like a polarizing player in a way. And you understand why, because hearing him voted the league's most overrated player by the players, you understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never considered him. I consider him an all-star point guard. And maybe not even one who makes it every single year, but an all-star caliber point guard who is not a franchise player. I have never considered him a franchise player. I absolutely think that he can be the lead guard on a team that's really good. That being said, this team improbably went to the seventh game of the finals, beating and then almost beating far more heralded and ballyhooed teams along the way. And as you said, Halliburton was not only the emotional leader, but the clutch player. Looked like now the clutch player in the league when it matters. So right. That's why he's kind of so, there's so many aspects of this, because it seems like whatever criticisms there were of them, he was answering it. And he was having the last laugh by continuing to play and being a primary reason why his team was continuing to play. So just very, very, you know, Tyrese Halliburton right now, you know, as an actor, when he is on the court, a hard player to know exactly where he slots into the overall NBA picture.
I mean, you know, as a lifelong Knicks fan, like I've just hated this dude for the last 2 years. It's just, I really was locked in on these finals entirely based on the Pacers narrative and this idea that they could beat this 68-win team with the highest point differential ever, but they're also really young, so they could, as, you know, David Mamet writes, crack out of turn, you know, and meanwhile, you've got like Rick Carlisle. I feel like a lot of people appreciated his coaching this postseason in a way we haven't heard in some time, you know, because, you know, the team is the team. And, you know, he just hasn't been discussed that much as like a top two coach in the NBA. Like, you know, I I'm only saying Spoelstra because that's what all the experts say. Like, you know, and the Heat do their thing in the playoffs, or have in the past. So now Spoelstra's great. So this is just where I am with this right now, is that it just really sucked. Like, it's like, can Tyrese do it? Can he do it? Oh my God, 9 points in 7 minutes on like 30 footers. Holy shit, am I seeing something historic? I love game sevens and all that shit. And then it just changed. And I don't know, yeah, it was just tough. And at some point, not having a world-class ball handler is just going to catch up to you when, I mean, Alex Caruso is insane. Lou Dort might be the strongest man in the NBA. It just caught up, and it just left a poor taste. And I'll tell you this is the first time in my lifetime that when I remember an NBA Finals, my first thought will be to the losing team.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we've talked about it all year long. The Thunder play a brand of defense that nobody else quite plays. And it seemed like Indiana, if not had solved it, had turned that tempo.
Mm-hmm.
The Thunder's defensive intensity almost always means that the tempo is in their favor, even in games they wind up losing. There's mm-hmm. that relentlessness. It didn't seem that way against the Pacers, and that's what was like, wow, I mean, is this like, you know, a team of destiny, but with far more substance, actually just a team that was always better than anybody ever gave them credit for, mm-hmm. or certainly better than it seemed as though their individual parts
mm-hmm.
were able to, you know, create as a championship winning squad. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, the Thunder, man, what, there's a lot you can talk about, of course. And I choose to talk about very little of it because I don't like that team. But I've never seen a team where no defensive rebound is safe.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I've never seen it like that, where a team will grab a defensive rebound and that ball is getting poked out of their hands without a foul being called, and all of a sudden the ball is now under Oklahoma's basket.
Mm-hmm.
This doesn't just happen like once every three games. It's like, ooh, heady play. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, have a certain defensive relentlessness on all aspects of the court. So it was very refreshing. And I mean, and Denver almost toppled it. They, mm-hmm. I did not think the Thunder looked juggernaut-y in this postseason, but they do what teams who wind up, you know, winning the championship do, which is win games against really, really energized opponents when you don't play your best. That's what the Celtics did last year. And that's what the Thunder did this year. They did not look as dominant as they did in the regular season, but they won the games that they needed to.
And they got an Aaron
sticking to that formula that they had been using all year.
Yeah. And let's not forget, they got that Aaron Gordon injury in game 7 against Denver too. Aaron Gordon's somehow become an excellent basketball player. And if
yeah, Gordon's really, really good.
You told me that when he was in Orlando, I would have had some disbelief that it would even work out for him. Honestly, like, it, to me, it was an open question. Like, will this guy end up closer to Harold Miner than, say, Harold Miner's not even fair.
No, that's not fair at all.
That's not fair in the slightest. I'm just trying to do like extreme. How about this? Is he going to be more of a, Andrew Wiggins on one side, or, you know, Julius Randle, all NBA Julius Randle on the other?
I'd say he's in between those two.
Yes. But maybe closer to Randle. All right, here's my Achilles thing, man. Oh yeah. Just, you know, I know, you know, I have to just say this is very impressive, and I don't love his game at all. But let's talk a little Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, because he deserves us to talk about him, because, yeah, and you even hear it now, like it's like, well, Jokic is still the best player, and he is still the best player, but sometimes that's said in a way to diminish him a little bit. And I just have to say, 30 point per game scorer who wins the MVP is also a 30 point per game scorer as a point average in the finals and wins a finals MVP. Did I make that clear enough? Sort of. 30 in the regular season and you win the MVP, 30 per game in the finals and you win finals MVP. That list is SGA and Michael Jordan. That's the whole list. And it's an incredible season. I don't even care about all the missed shots yesterday because he was controlling the pace and everybody else looked like they were shitting their britches. He had 12 assists and one turnover. An incredible season, an incredible player, and, you know, and he got incredibly lucky because the other team's best player had a torn Achilles.
You just said it. I mean, Gilgeous, I thought he should have been the MVP, and right. I mean, best player, you get rewarded. Charles Barkley deserved...
Agreed.
MVP for the season the Suns had. And I don't think in general anybody thought he was better than Jordan or Olajuwon.
Mm-hmm.
But it was his. I mean, he was the dominant player on that team. And Gilgeous is kind of like that. I mean, it wasn't this Thunder team wasn't just a collection of scrappers. They were led by one of the best scorers in the league who brought it every single night and was clearly the offensive leader, which allowed everybody else who, again, I don't think they have a loaded squad. Mm-hmm. It is to their testament. It is more, again, a testament to them. They are not loaded. They've got a great player. Jalen Williams kind of looks like a great player.
Still so young.
And then so many people were essential to what they did. But again, I don't look at this as like, ooh, they had such a deep, talented squad. It was just brilliant roster construction, in my opinion, and a deserved championship. Gilgis, and so...
Can I respond just really quick on the roster construction question and then throw it back to you for Gilgis? Yeah, I agree with you on the question of like raw talent versus roster construction. And I really do think that's why Sam Presti and Daganal deserve a lot of credit, because Presti was clearly going after, and this is why people laugh about all the like the psychological stuff and the interviews that go into drafting people. But that shit is actually really important, because they were looking for people who would be like, okay, all we want you to do, Cason Wallace or Aaron Wiggins, or we're going to bring you in Caruso, and we're not even going to play you most of the season, whether you like it or not, because we want you to be fresh for the playoffs. And Caruso's fine with that. And Wallace is fine with that. And so is Wiggins. And so's the other Williams. And so's the other Jalen Williams. And like, these dudes are all just like, we don't care. Now that could change because they're really young, and you know, you get the gift of me or whatever the hell Pat Riley used to call it. You know, Cason Wallace might be like, where's my team? I already have a championship. Trade me somewhere now. I'm less confident than others that it'll last, but the fact that they found these guys who are kind of egoless in terms of what they were asked to do, get out of the way for Shea and sometimes get out of the way for Jalen, and, you know, it's just like, like very impressive roster construction. You put it perfectly.
No. And I mean, I don't think, you know, you mentioned Wallace and that's the perfect guy. Cause right. I think not everybody would sign on to playing the role in that system. And he was a huge part of that. You want to talk about like timely steals and timely three pointers, like Wallace was doing them just about every game. So I think that he's probably smart enough not to request a trade or publicly inflate his own value while he's still on his rookie contract. I think what's more likely to happen, which is what happens with championship teams who play a lot of games in the spotlight en route to winning a championship, is that Wallace will probably have a really big next contract outside of Oklahoma somewhere. His stature will probably I think, you know, he's gonna, you know, if he can only increase his value on a team that wins more, I don't think he's gonna look to get out of there. I think he knows he's gonna cash in pretty soon.
Right. And they have so many picks, they can revolving door a lot of people who want to be part of a brilliant system where they know they can get better. And they know they can be like Cason Wallace and get that bigger contract somewhere else. It becomes very attractive.
Yes, for sure. For sure. Before we move off the Thunder, I will say, and I guess there's no kind of graceful way to say this without sounding bitter. And I've acknowledged that I don't like the Thunder and didn't believe in them. And they proved me wrong on everything. So whatever, you know, whatever shit I need to eat, I've eaten. But I will say, man, does Gil just get the Jordan whistle? He gets calls that no other players do ever, starting in the first quarter. The referees have decided, and he is the best player on the best team, the deserved MVP for this season. I'm not trying to give a counter to his accomplishments, but I am saying, when you talk about averaging 30 and you talk about winning a tough game by four. And I can remember 8 free throws that he hit where the referees have decided that he is the person who gets hit anytime he puts the ball on the floor. It happened once Jordan came back. Once it was late career Jordan, that's what it was.
Especially in the playoffs.
He would dive in the middle and he would shoot 12 free throws every fourth quarter.
Especially in the playoffs.
And again, I will say that Gilgeous right now has been anointed as the guy who gets fouled all the time. And when you are above 80% shooter, and you're getting sent to the free throw line so many times, I'm saying that can be a factor in raising your impressive points per game average and can be a factor in a team winning a close game.
Okay. D'accord. I disagree with nothing, except I'm also just going to give Shai props for seeing that he's going to get that whistle. And he's brilliant at putting himself in positions to get that whistle. I mean, do I like it that he will hook Nembhard's arm in the crook of his arm in a way that's so quick twitch that the refs think it's Nembhard grabbing the crook of Shai's arm? Do I like that? No.
But at least, Dave, at least that example, there was contact.
Yes.
In that example, there was contact that Gilgeous is initiating. I'm saying, like, he's just
like no contact.
A player is in his vicinity, moving laterally with him, and a whistle is blown.
No, it is frustrating, for sure. And you know, I think this is going to be one of those things where, the same way in 2015, the Warriors win the title. A lot of folks were like, no Kyrie, no Love. Okay. You know, that's really not the finals we were hoping to see, even though LeBron had just this incredible performance. And I'm still curious why Iguodala wins the MVP for his defense on LeBron. It's just always been like weird to me. I don't know what that's about. It was almost like a good citizenship award because everybody loves Iguodala. It really should have been like the Jerry West thing where the MVP goes to the losing team. Only time it happened was West. All right. The point is that I think this has a massive asterisk on it. Let's see how they do next year. Not mammoth. All right, fine. But I think everyone's going to remember. I know. I overstep sometimes.
You think there is an asterisk because Tyrese Halliburton got hurt in the game 7?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, not a big one. But it's there. The question lingers. I mean, if you look at it objectively, team loses best player 9 minutes into game 7.
And then commits a shitload of turnovers? Yes, yes, absolutely a factor. But
yes,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And damn, man, the TJ McConnell experience was so much fun in the last couple of games. You know, a sucker for a guy with shifty moves and footwork. But let me ask you this question. I cannot see, because of his lack of a three ball, someone being like, why can't that guy be Brunson 2.0? I don't see that. And you hear people talk about that. How is that different from Brunson? And it's like, threes matter so much in today's NBA that if your point can't really shoot them, or need 6 seconds to set up. I just don't think that works for a 34-minute a game player, but please go ahead.
There were times throughout the playoffs, but particularly in the finals, where it seemed as though the Pacers were staying in a game on the back of TJ McConnell's scoring.
Yes.
And if that took you by, if that took viewers by surprise, then you just haven't seen that much TJ ever since he was mm-hmm. back with the Sixers.
He was great on
that.
The
is who he is. TJ mm-hmm. McConnell is a confoundingly versatile scorer. One-on-one score, one-on-two score, and clutch score almost always, as you said, impressively, and also shows his limitations on the wider scale, almost all in the paint or certainly within the 2-point line. And for a guy who is about 5'11 and is incredible, not explosive, that is, you know, the way he's doing it is very impressive. He's a great natural scorer. I was wondering why TJ was on the bench for the majority of fourth quarters. And on offense, Indiana was struggling a little more than when he was on. And it was just, okay, I guess I'm not holding a magnifying glass onto this when Indiana's on defense. But I guess it makes sense that McConnell hurts them on defense. You know, and that, you know, and that's why when he has been their most steady offensive player, Carlisle is running mostly with, you know, and even when Halliburton was out, particularly, you know, he was going with Nembhard, Nesmith, and Mathurin. And it's like McConnell, but it's like, you know, and you can, and I'm not even saying, Cola, what are you doing? I'm saying, oh, there's a reason for that. Carlisle knows how good McConnell is on offense, but it's like, right, why isn't, you know, Brunson is a good comparison because of the style of games they play. Jalen, yes, has that range out to three, is a good 3-point shooter, good clutch 3-point shooter. And while Brunson is certainly not a strong one-on-one defender and is very often kind of hidden on defense by his fellow starters, he's got 2 or 3 inches on McConnell.
Yeah.
And I think that that does make a difference, you know, that does make a difference. You know, it's like, oh, has TJ shown that he is a starting caliber point guard in this league? On offense, it certainly looks like he has. You know, when he's got it going, he looks like New Orleans' Chris Paul sometimes. Looks like he's making the right decision on every single possession.
Except, yeah, I mean, that's...
But that is always in a reserve role. And there is a reason why over probably close to a decade career now, with him always being in a team's rotation. But there's a reason why he has not been elevated from that role and why no team has attempted to poach him.
No, that's right. All I can say... I agreed with some stuff you said. I disagreed with other stuff you said in that broad assessment, but none of the agreements or disagreements rise to the level of discussion. But what I do want to say is, you know, because I read some stuff on this very topic about what reasons TJ should not be a starting point guard. And the defense thing, most people, the consensus was he makes up for in being like that kind of a pest on the perimeter, that it makes up. They don't have to hide him, basically. It's like, and that's a big difference from Jalen. He doesn't have to be hidden. And if TJ gets 4 steals in a game, no one's shocked, even if he only plays 20 minutes. They even have a play they call the TJ where he steals it when they're throwing it in when he scores a layup, so he's already up close, steals it on the throw-in, and then hits another layup. It's happened like 3 or 4 times since he's been a Pacer, and once in the playoffs. What I've read is, so it's not the defense, you know, a little bit on the 3-point shooting, but the bigger thing is people say that they've heard Carlisle say that insane intensity with which he plays with, those 2-stop jumps, that incredible quick lift he gets off on that shot, that it takes a pretty intense physical toll. Like he plays like, you know, almost like a relief pitcher, you know, like you say, like, why doesn't Felix Bautista start for the Orioles if he's their best pitcher? It's like, well, he throws 100 miles an hour and his arm would fall off, you know? And that's kind of like TJ. It's like he goes 100 miles an hour, and then it's just like, do you really want him playing defense in the fourth quarter? You know, do you really want him dribbling a little bit tired? If that's the other thing, like he can be trapped easily. He has to, but you're right. If you get him set up on the perimeter with someone trying to guard him, I mean, I just felt like it was lights out, which is cool. For someone of that size. It's just cool. Same way it's cool to see Felix Bautista or the late Dan Quisenberry. All right, so Shiraz, can I talk a little Achilles stuff, please? All right, here's the general theory, Shiraz. We talked about it before. Almost twice as many Achilles injuries with players significantly younger than the previous found record of 2014. Here's my general thoughts about this. The game is so different than when you and I were coming up in terms of the amount of running and cutting these guys do. I just feel like it's a pretty intensely physically draining operation. And also, weirdly, the players, I think, are in significantly better shape. Like, who's in better shape, Aaron Nesmith or, you know, Sidney Green, former Knicks power forward? But it's, you know, much less, you know, much, you know, diets, all that stuff. So these players have this amazing cardiovascular. So they're cutting and moving around like never before. And, you know, they don't get out of breath, really. So it's like their bodies just fall apart. And I just think the game has become too goddamn intense for 82 games. So their bodies wear out. And the best players have the highest usage rates. So they're the ones most at risk of tearing an Achilles. And so we lose Tatum. And it would have been so much fun to beat the Celtics with Tatum and to see his ass slump off the court. I mean, the Knicks beat the Celtics with Tatum on the court. I mean, I wanted that moment so badly. So this is where I come out at this. We need a 62-game season. The seasons need to be shorter. They could maybe make some rules about load management, like 55 and up or something. Every game would matter more. And it's just the bosses, I think, would be the primary block to this because of profits. I think most fans would dig it. Thoughts to you. And it would be safer for the players. Thoughts
why
to
would
you.
Why would most fans dig 20 less games a year?
Because then the games have more import and maybe the stars are more likely to come out so you don't get the bad games.
I figured that the reason you were broaching this was because of the Achilles injuries. And No, I think that would be a terrible idea. I think that it's because there have been high profile players. So now it's a problem. Now it's an epidemic. I absolutely disagree with that. I mean, I don't feel as though players are just playing so much damn harder. I mean, I think that's horseshit actually. And I mean, the NBA season is 82 games. Ooh. And the players when we were growing up were in unbelievable shape. So when Vlade's the guy you still talk about as a chain smoker because he was the chain smoker. It was not a league full of camel puffers. I mean, like, that's why the few guys, we still remember them as such, because when we were growing up, NBA players were in unbelievable shape. And there were more ankle injuries because it was played within the two-point line. So there was everybody's feet to land on. Every time you went up, there was a dozen feet under the basket. Now there's not. So I'm just saying, I think a 62-game season would be absurd. I think a 72-game season would be too few. I mean, I think that might be getting in the right direction, but I don't think there's a right direction to play in. Players have access. Players, I think that's the problem. Not only do players and teams have access to everything, but there's too much. There's too much. And what they're being fed and sold, is probably clashing with itself at times. So, I mean, saying, oh, you know, yeah, you know, the 82 game season was good enough for Moses Malone and also Jeff Malone. But for now, because of how the game is and we got to protect these guys, I don't think there's nothing about that statement which resonates as true for me.
What about the number of Achilles injuries, though? I can't call it a fluke at this point.
Who went down besides Tatum, Lillard, and Haliburton? Because Irving has an ACL.
Yeah,
people tear their ACLs every year.
Yeah. That's true too.
And I'm not trying to.
No, DeJounte. Also,
I can't think who tore their Achilles earlier in the year.
DeJounte Murray did. One of my
love DeJounte.
Fave players. Yep. I love DeJounte. Let's see. I'm trying to think. All right.
Is there more cutting?
Are there more?
There's more chucking, but I don't think there's so many motion offenses. I think there are fewer screen, you know, and like players are spotting up a lot more than they used to. I don't think that there's necessarily more cutting. And if this style of play, this perimeter heavy style of play is straining Achilles, it's preserving the knees more than the game used to.
We got,
and I'm not a doctor, but
we got, lesser players, although, you know, I do feel bad. Like James Wiseman tore his Achilles this year.
Yeah.
Isaiah Jackson, Drew Smith, with the Heat.
That's a lot of Achilles. Yeah. That's a lot of torn Achilles.
And it's so brutal. That's
a shitty injury, but
18 months out, it's just three times in the playoffs with three of your most high-profile players. I think it has to be a discussion. I mean, otherwise, what kind of product are you putting out as a league? I mean, the Eastern Conference
I cannot agree with you less.
Conference next year is going to be players, so disappointing.
So who's going to watch? Because anytime
it's not who's going to watch.
Steps on the floor, they could tear their Achilles.
No, that's not the point at all. It's trying to make it the game exist in a way that comports with how people, you know, the science they're saying people are running more on the court. There's more movement. There's more back and forth. The defensive intensity and how they measure it. You know, people are just putting more stress on these joints now. And for me, when I go back and watch like a typical game from
what
like 1988. Unless you're talking about like
what
the Bad Boys or something.
Comparable to how any other era played defense.
It's pretty terrible. And there is the concern. Like, I don't want to see, it's not about, I want to see the best play against the best, especially in the playoffs. I love watching Lillard in the playoffs. And if there's a way to make the game, safer on the question of wear and tear. I mean, doctors are going to have to weigh in, but if there's a way to make it safer on the wear and tear question on these Achilles, so we have less people losing 18 months of their careers, I think that has to be explored.
It will be explored, but I think that it is a completely hysterical reaction to something. Really, like, you know, right. You even said it. We want to see the best against the best. And Achilles are tearing left and right. I mean, I honestly don't think that's true. It's like, you know, it's bad luck. It's bad luck. Three players throw their Achilles in the postseason. You know, I wonder how many again. And I don't know because I don't know any stats. But how many Achilles tears were there in the last three postseasons before this combined? I don't know, which is why I'm saying I think that it is and you even said it, and you're not a hysterical person, but you were like, oh, this now has to be addressed because famous players tore their Achilles. And
famous. Really, no, that makes it a little bit like,
Dave, you said you want the best against the best. And in this one,
incredibly skilled player.
And this year, this year was under the sign of the apocalypse the entire year, everything that happened this year. But, you know, saying, well now, I mean, right. That is treating it as an epidemic. That is treating it as an epidemic. And players who tear their Achilles range from 38 minutes a game guys to guys who are out of their team's rotation. That's the scary thing about the Achilles. It is not, you know, oh, if only that guy had worked his calves harder. That's the scary thing about the Achilles. You're moving and then you can't move. So, you know, it is the fluke injury. And I certainly don't
But what if it's not a fluke injury? What if it, I mean, what if they can actually look at this and say it is a function of how players play, how many minutes they play, the amount of AAU players play, the existence of their whole lives being 365-day basketball players, which is a pretty recent phenomenon in the world over the last, you know, couple decades at most. You know, we're in the 21st century talking about this. So you've got these guys playing with the intensity and, unfortunately, because of the parents and the culture, with the stakes and pressure of doing that for an incredible, I mean, we talk about miles on the body. I mean, it's incomprehensible to me with this generation. And maybe the Achilles is connected to that. Maybe other injuries are connected to that. This whole season felt like a shit ton of injuries left and right of some of the most fun players. It's like, I like watching the stars because more often than not, they're also the players who play the game at the highest level, and that makes it terrific. But it's also not just the stars. I think it's a broader safety question because of the AAU culture, the amount of miles on these bodies. And if there is a way to address that in a way that addresses player safety, and I'll take you at your, you know, at your word, definitely, about your thinking on the fact that, like, we don't know. But I'm saying, like, so we shouldn't be making bold proclamations. But I think the science, they're going to be studying this really hard. And I'm very interested in what they'll find out, like, given what the body is going through to play basketball at the professional level and the journey to that point in 2025.
What you said about basketball culture, I think, makes a lot of sense, makes the most sense of your side of the argument, for sure, because you're right. By the time players make it to the NBA, the amount of basketball they have played is, you are absolutely right. So the amount of the tread on legs and on feet and on joints, yes, is so much more than it was. Right. In our day, the best basketball players
played baseball.
In the fall, they were like the best football players, and in the spring, yeah, they were the best baseball players. And winter was their best, and basketball was their winter sport. So no, I think you are, and as a somebody who works in youth sports, I am very, very unhappy about that trend, and about when I came to realize that that's what sports had become, and that's what sports had become in the city that I grew up playing all sports in. So no, I think there is a lot of validity to that. I don't think making the NBA season shorter personally is the answer. And I do think, Dave, that because you keep saying, you keep saying you want to see the best players on the court. And I think that that is something that almost anybody, rabid fans and casual fans and people who make money off of advertising, would certainly agree with that. But right, if it was a non-starter, if it was Sam Hauser and DeLon Wright,
two of my faves,
and whoever on the Pacers, I think that the stat would be that there was 8 Achilles injuries this year, 3 in the playoffs, and oh right, DeJounte Murray got right around the All-Star break him. That's a big one. But I think that it is the caliber of the players that are making you and probably a lot of other people feeling as though this is now a problem. If it was 3 bench players, I don't think we'd be having this discussion. Well, I don't think we'd be looking at it as a problem. And you're right.
The fact 8 is that a much bigger number than 3 the fact when you talk about the NBA.
The fact that
it's a lot of players. 8. They've never had that. Not even close. I mean, it's a problem. They need to figure out why. And about the best players, I'll say it again. It's like when you are dealing with, this is about tread on the tires, then we're dealing with the question of also usage rate. And so it will trend as far, like if you're like walking on a rickety bridge across a volcano, it's like, this is what's going to be the people who are might be most likely to fall because of how much they've played their whole lives. How much AAU did Jason Tatum play, for God's sakes? I mean, it's ridiculous. So that's the concern. And I don't know. I can't say that loudly enough. I don't know. But I really do hope that the owners pursue some way to understand the question of injuries and the amount that these players are playing. And is there a way we should be rejigging this or not? Whatever they say it is, I want to hear it. I want Joel Embiid to be able, like, here's the thing. I'll leave with this on this. Like, I can't imagine Joel Embiid making it through four rounds of the NBA playoffs. And that bums me out. And it's not even about Joel. It's about, I would like to feel like the players can be stable enough, because Joel's not the best example, but I just like the idea of feeling like someone's not going to look like they got hit with a sniper in game 7 of the NBA finals.
Cause it just happened for the first time. Cause it just happened. If I didn't know the NBA and I were listening to you, I would think players are dropping all.
That's not fair, man. I've been saying 8 since the beginning.
You know,
I've been saying number 8. I never said players are dropping like flies. I said 8. 8.
But the gravity in your tone makes it seem, and it makes it seem
8 is a lot.
Like this is should it be re-examined at the youth basketball level? Sure. And how youth schedules and travel basketball is conducted. And that is such a huge cash cow that I'm sure that no necessary changes are going to be made there. And I am not dismissing what you are saying in that regard. And I agree that the best players are the ones likely to have been the best players their whole careers, likely to have played heavy work minute loads every stop across their career, making them more susceptible to this injury. So I agree. But this whole, I don't know, I guess that I'm rejecting the notion of like, we got to protect the players because right now their health is in peril. That, you know, like, I don't agree with that. You know, you kind of even recognize that, as you were saying, Embiid came in. Embiid missed his first two seasons.
Yeah, he's a rough example.
He's another Ming was just one of those guys.
Yeah, no, especially so with big guys.
So big that his lower body was going to break. And I know now we are talking about guards mostly. We're talking about guards and we're talking about younger guards. And I'm aware of that. I totally am. But
see, the thing about it happening to Halliburton in game 7, it's not just like the recency bias of saying, whoa, because it happened in game 7, we need a congressional panel. It's saying, whoa, we just experienced this with Jason Tatum. And after that, we just experienced with Damian Lillard. And we have a sport, and I'm speaking like as if I'm in like some sort of NBA higher up. It's like, we need to figure out what's happening right now, the same way they had to do this. And see, that's the thing too. It's like, it didn't, like in football, they just banned something called the drop tackle. I'm getting the name wrong a little bit. And I'll have to look it up, but it was like, it just happened like once or twice. And then they were like, whoa, like the likelihood, the hip drop tackle, the likelihood of this ending somebody's season by a tackle that people have been doing forever, they're just like, it's just not working. So we're going to ban this particular tackle. And that was, you know, celebrated by the players because, you know, players like Mark Andrews missed the whole season. It didn't happen to dozens of players, but it happened enough that they investigated why this tackle happens to be doing this now. And that's been like universally, like both sides have been like, yeah, that was the right thing to do. The same thing with the horse collar tackle, which was big when we were coming up, which is now completely banned. It snapped a couple of players' legs and they said, we can't do this anymore. I think that's smart to tinker with a sport in the name of player safety.
That statement on its own, I cannot argue with. I
Gotta
do not think
tinker.
that I don't think that players' health is being compromised.
I mean,
Is why I don't agree with that. And do I have data to support that? No, I don't. And if some kind of recognized medical body tasked with, whether it's independent study or league commissioned, tasked with that, recommends that 15 fewer games in an NBA season, would kind of do the trick, then I'm sure that will be looked into. Again, I think that you saying the, I mean, what really matters, I think, is not an NBA, because again, of course, I have no numbers offhand, but I'd say maybe five players played 82 games this year. That might be something I will look up because I'm interested in that. But like playing 82, I mean, it's an 82 game season, but ain't nobody playing 82 games. Not that many players are playing 79 games. So I think a study like this could open itself up to saying we recommend that there's even the players rest more. So, all right. So in a way, you're saying, all right, let's have a 62 game season, and then we'll have a lot of players playing 62 games, the entire schedule. Okay, so that has, that is a very that's a valid counter argument right
Well, they're
there.
always, yeah, there's going to be the law of unintended consequences to any reforms that they put forward. There always are. There
Yes, I
always
think we're in
are.
a spot right
Like,
now where more players are tearing their Achilles and fewer players are tearing their ACLs. Which was an injury that about four or five players used to have every year. Now it's not. Kyrie
because of
didn't anyway.
advances in medical science, though, and also an ACL injury is now a much shorter, it used to be like a death knell for a career. I mean, these advances in medical science have made it safer on the knees for NBA
And
players.
I'm sure
How
they're
they
working on the
rehab,
Achilles.
I certainly hope so, because Achilles is winning as of today, 8-0. Incredible number of Achilles tears for one season with players so young. That's the other thing. When I said the previous record from 2014, yeah, it was a bunch of old guys. Because that's what happened to an Achilles when it would happen. It happened because you were old. A lot of tread on the tires. If we're really accepting that argument about tread on the tires, then it actually makes a lot of sense that it would skew younger.
Yes, it does. It does.
It's too bad. Oh, last night, man. Not a fun game for Dave Z. I didn't like that at all. I like the first half.
Right. And maybe the fact that I missed the Halliburton injury in real time,
Maybe.
it's not as vivid for me, but I no, believe me, if
It
this
was
is
a
what you're
crazy
thinking,
scene. It was a
if
crazy scene.
No, I know it was very, like very dramatic and all that.
Yeah.
Everybody carrying on. But like yeah, listen, I'm sure it you're not the only one who feels as though the numbers are startling enough that it has to be addressed and we have to have answers as to why this might be happening. And sure, I'm not going to be, there's no reason for me to to oppose that. Yeah, I do not think that players are working so much harder.
Okay.
I really don't. So, so maybe that just goes to yours, but, and I'll say it for the last time, because I agree so strongly. No, you're right. By the time dudes hit the NBA, they have played so much more basketball, even arriving at a younger age than older rookies used to, just because it was not 12 months a year, and it was not supposed. No sport except professional wrestling is ever supposed to be 12 months a year because of the physical toll that it takes on a body, and that's what sports is now. Whatever sport a child or their families deem is their sport. So yes, I very much agree. That is a possible factor as to why the numbers of that particular injury have risen this year.
No, I hear you. I hear you. It's it's just tough when also like you hear people like Kerr and Popovich make the case for a shorter season. Those are compelling people to me who know a lot about the game. And also like Kerr played in the 80s for goodness sakes. And so if he's saying these players play with more torque, more cutting, and that he sees it in his players' limbs and joints and the therapy they do. I mean, that just has a lot of credibility for me in terms of shaping the opinion of the moment here and how people, and people are taking all sides on this. There's not like a wave being like this must be shortened. I mean, it's starting a real debate though, and I welcome the debate because I think it's good for the league. I mean, the league has been pretty static for a while. I think there are a lot of rules changes they should be thinking about. And I think they're shockingly afraid of change in an atmosphere where baseball and football have been more ready to adapt change. And that wasn't the way under David Stern. I think it's a silverism.
Yeah.
I don't always miss Stern, but sometimes I do.
When I see Adam Silver, I miss Stern.
Exactly. Jeez.
Otherwise, I don't really think about him.
I think about him. He played just this pivotal role in why there's FanDuel, all that crap, the legal sports gambling. That's Silver's legacy.
No, and I think for me, I mean, the most compelling argument I can make to myself, which is really not much of an argument, is the NBA season's always been 82 games. The NBA season is 82 games. And to me, that is such a, of course, there's comfort and familiarity, but also, no, after 82 games, then the postseason is set. That seems to me, yeah, you've played a full, every team playing three times a week. That's right. 62 games. I mean, like that totally alters. You can play like once or twice a week, or have just like a shorter time frame. Okay, I don't welcome that, but I also don't feel. And granted, I did not. This was far from my favorite NBA season. But I rarely do I watch the game, and I watch a good amount of NBA basketball. Rarely am I watching a game where I'm like, wow, these two teams are kind of phoning it in. The organizations might be by who they deem
No, especially.
active, but I don't feel, because you're saying, oh, it would bring more, the games would mean more.
No, I don't mean more.
I
I just
feel
mean by
as
pure
though players are
percentages.
not playing inspired basketball or trying, or just kind of phoning it in.
I
I don't
agree.
feel
Yeah, that
that way when
wasn't
I
the
watch a
point
game.
I was making. So that I'm glad you clarified that. It's more like I remember the 90, 98, 99 season. For me personally, this is just me. There were something like, 55 games that year, 54 something. And I had so much fun that season because it really did feel like every game was kind of like a 20% of a playoff game. Like it just felt like there were stakes. And that was fun. And so I have thought about that because, and I know some of this has to do with being in Wizards land, but season fatigue can be a real thing. When your team ain't great. So, but I mean, if nothing else, it just, and we've all got NBA League Pass, or at least you and I do. So it's like you can watch other stuff. But, if you're committed to the home team and a season is tough, at the very least, it lets you see the side of the story that says, okay, what would it mean less, more for the fan experience? Now, for the players, I think it was great for people like Bub Carrington to have the extra games. It was actually really cool when Marcus Smart came in. So, yeah, good for the team. Like it. I want to see what people have to say about it. I'm very curious. Let's put it out to you, the listener, if you have any feelings about the NBA season being shortened. Do zap an email. You know where to send it to. Just send it to dave@edgesports.com. Brought to you by The Nation Magazine. Shiraz, any last thoughts about Durant? Do you like him on Houston?
I don't even know what to think, really, because at the begin last year's offseason, post Olympics, I was so high on Durant, and we discussed it. I had like re-crushed on Durant pretty hard, and because of that, thought that that would propel the Suns to the finals. Instead, they didn't make the play in, and their coach was fired after a year. So I'm definitely tempering down my enthusiasm for Durant. And also, it's funny. I mean, the news, I think with Durant now, there have been so many transactions that it kind of loses its impact, you know? Like, you'd think the trade of Kevin Durant would still be league shattering. And I'm sure much of the league community is feeling shattered, or is at least adjusting to this and very present of it. For me, it was like, oh, Durant on the move again, right? Oh, now he's in Houston. Houston should feel really good about it.
Yeah, I find it interesting from the perspective.
They should feel really, really good about it. They came in second in the West with Şengün as their best player, and then Jalen Green and Amen Thompson as, like, you know, the rounding out, like, the three of a very deep
three.
Team. Of a very deep and versatile team. But that team finished number two with that as your star power. Now it's Durant, Şengün, and Thompson. On paper, that looks better and sounds a lot more prosperous. But right, I mean, and actually, when Durant played on Phoenix last year, they were a winning team. They were abysmal when he didn't play, but when, you know, like, they won more than they lost when he played, and he played really well again. But at least at this stage, you know, I don't feel like making any kind of lofty predictions one way or another. I don't think it'll suck for Houston. It could be really good. And for the Suns, I think this definitely signals a rebuild.
Interesting that you always want players who you think affect winning. And the Suns were considered a league-wide catastrophe this past year, and deservedly so, given everything that was going on at that team. They won 45 games in the Western Conference. You know, that is not that, you know, Houston won 50. You know,
The Suns won 45 games.
Let me look that up so I don't
say. I don't think so.
Let's look it up. Let's look it up. That's what the computador is for.
Oh, yeah.
Nicaragua. Let's see what we got. All right. I thought I was right about that. Let's see what we got here.
I'm thinking like 38.
Okay. A man's is thinking 38. And the answer B. Oh, yeah, they were awful. My bad.
How many they win?
36 and 46. I thought they won 45 and came in. No. Yeah, that, you know what it was? The drop-off is so intense. Like, Grizzlies are the eighth seed with 48. And then you have Kings at 9 with 40.
Yeah, Suns were bad.
Oh, yeah, they were horrible.
Suns weren't victim of being in a good conference. They were bad.
Yeah, they were shit. And a lot of people, not just you, pick them to go very, very far in the playoffs. That was a pretty, like, almost like universally thought thing. And, like, unlike, you know, the aforementioned, you know, OKC thoughts you had preseason, this was like, I believed in them.
Because they had actually had a decent season.
And a good offseason.
Under Vogel. And then the thought was that threesome never worked together. So this year it'll work better, and you have Budenholzer.
And Tyus Jones.
Everything seemed to be. It wasn't just like it seemed because the Suns had been good and still were a disappointing team. Pardon me. So now it certainly seemed as though they had addressed that. They were very aware of what had made them disappointing and had worked to patch that up. So I think, you know, it looked like it kind of made sense. It didn't turn out.
Yeah. And I just, the last thing I say about the trade is just, first of all, I got to say, man, until as recently as 2 years ago, a signed Bradley Beal jersey was on my son's wall. And just how that career has careened to now being, oh, that's the worst contract in the NBA. You know, and just, wow. a gutter of franchises. And then it's like, how did he get a $50 million a year contract with a no trade clause? The
The no
NBA's
trade
only
clause
no trade
was the
clause.
big coup. That was
Amazing.
the big coup.
But who's the idiot here? Is it Ted Leonsis is the idiot, or is Bradley Beal's agent, I don't know, Sonny Spoon?
I think there's probably a lot of idiocy to dole around.
Can we pretend that his agent is Sonny Spoon?
Sure, I won't contradict that.
The great Mario Van
What
Peebles.
do I know?
A great deal. You're a very wise man.
Not about who's going to win in the NBA these days.
It's a some of these are tough calls. I mean, like I said, the Suns thing was terrible. I had the Ma I mean, who could have predicted what the Mavs were gonna do? But I had the Mavs going deep back, again. Crazy league, man. Crazy league. But in some ways, I got to tell you, it's why I watch, because it is unpredictable. Like Durant on Houston is, and the fact that Houston didn't have to give up one of those young dudes, not even Jabari Smith Jr.
No, it was it it's yes, it was a very good deal for the Rockets, it seems.
Not even Cam Whitmore, who they don't even
But
play.
they don't even like.
Reed Sheppard, who was supposed to be rookie of the year last year and played 5 minutes a game. They were like, you get nothing.
Could turn out great for Houston, but
Yeah.
I'm not ready to crow about Durant for a second straight season, not yet, until
What a
yet.
weird
Maybe in
career.
August. The last I will say,
What a weird career.
Durant,
Yeah.
totally weird.
For an
And that means one
all-timer.
of the best ever, which is what makes it extra weird. Exactly.
Yeah.
My bon voyage to the season is that if I were an NBA fan, which I am, if I were an NBA scribe, which I'm not, and if I were them, I would feel like the Thunder should go in again looking to repeat. And if anybody feels as though they're the favorite to repeat, just like last year the Celtics were the favorite to repeat, then I think there's a lot of reasons why that would be a sensible prediction. I will say that if I'm fortunate enough to be invited back to the edge of sports to
Of
talk about
course.
the next NBA season, crossing my fingers on that, then I will not be predicting the Thunder to win the NBA title. So
Excellent.
that I
I
can
mean,
bow.
you know what? You know what you just did, man? You threw out some such delicious chum in the water that, of course, Jaws is going to come back for you. This, let's call it. I mean, we got to do a draft show, of course, if anything interesting happens. If not, fuck it. But later in the summer, for sure, summer league, what's happening? I mean, I love that the NBA is also, unlike when we were growing up, a year-round sport. I mean, we complain about youth basketball and other youth sports being year-round, but when it comes to the league itself, I mean, I dig the content. I want to know who's popping in summer league. I find that interesting,
Oh, well, I think, yeah, I think draft and then really free agency at the beginning of July, and free agency is usually at its busiest and hottest while summer league is going on in Vegas. So I'd say, likely after the free agent frenzy is when, you and I will have a lot of stuff to talk about.
And I'll also say for people who want to tune in, because this fall for what our predictions are going to be, all I have to say is if the Denver Nuggets have the off season that I think they're going to have in filling out that bench, well, my pick is in. They took this Thunder team to 7 games. Aaron Gordon, this close to a torn Achilles. This close. You saw it
You
buckling.
saw it ready to you're ready to burst. You're right. It was
Man,
right
you
there in
could.
front of the cameras.
Yeah, Mike Breen could have picked his teeth with it. Well, Shiraz, thanks so much for joining us on, and I'm putting this in quotes, the last episode of the 24-25 NBA season. Well, I guess it is. But thank you for joining us for the last episode covering the 24-25 season. It was awesome to talk to you this year, man.
Thank you. Yes, an absolute blast. Thank you for including me in it.
Man, it's been fun as hell. Yo, for everybody out there listening, I strongly recommend the movie Internal Affairs with Richard Gere. And for everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. Thank you to the nation. We are out of here. Peace.